Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to call this meeting to order of the House Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. Glad to have everyone here with us this afternoon. The first order of business will be for the to call the roll. And so if you're not a member, camera, in other words, and committee legislative assistant will call the roll.
Liebling.
Ms. Niederhoff.
Liebling.
Present.
Hewitt.
Present.
Schumacher.
Schumacher, present.
Ackland.
Ackland, present.
Backer.
Backer, present.
Bonner. Bonner.
Bonner, present.
Bierman.
Present.
Bolden.
Present.
Damoth.
Damoth, present.
Freiberg.
Present.
Grinhagen.
Present.
Heal.
Present.
Morrison.
Present.
Munson.
Present.
Pryor.
Present.
Quam.
Present.
Breyer.
Present.
Schultz.
Present.
Wolgamott.
Present.
Great. Everyone is here.
All right, thank you. A quorum is present. Is there a motion to approve the minutes of January 19th?
Madam Chair, so moved.
Thank you. Representative Hewitt moves approval of the minutes of January 19th. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, please, members, please unmute. We'll just take a voice vote. All those in favor of approval of the minutes of January 19th, please say aye.
Aye.
And thank you. Okay, let's see. Oh, I'm sorry. You know what? It was the 20th. I'm getting a text that there was a typo on the agenda. So we'll just take another vote if that's okay. It's the minutes of January the 20th that we need to approve. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no? Okay, thank you. The motion is approved. Okay, well, members, we have an extensive agenda today, and I would just like to say a couple of words about it, because really we're going to be covering something extremely important today, and that is our emergency services system for the state. We have a couple of members on our committee who, in fact, have personal experience with this, and those are Representative Hewitt and Representative Backer. And that is a wonderful resource for this committee. But what we're doing today is giving an overview of this topic. And I want to really emphasize this because there are a lot of needs and challenges and probably opinions about the system. And what this is really intended to do today is just give members an overview of the system on the assumption that we and possibly the public don't know a lot about how the system is functioning, is supposed to function, or could function. So, you know, just to lay the groundwork, this obviously is a critical issue for every Minnesotan. And I think that we can all agree that when a person has an emergency medical need, say a heart attack, that wherever they live in the state, that they should get emergency service that is quick, that they should get service from someone who is well-trained to help them, and that the service should be affordable to them. And so this is, I think, probably a shared goal. I don't think we need to have any dispute or debate about that. But we do know that our system has a lot of challenges. And there are many perspectives on those, and many, there will be many opinions. So I just want to lay the groundwork today that we are not here to have a debate about the system. We're here to make changes to the system today. What we're really just looking for is an overview. And so we're going to start out with House research and have just understand a little bit about the system. What I would like to do is to just ask members to hold your questions to the end of each section. So we'll have the overviews. We'll first hear from House Research. We'll hear from Tony Spector, who's the, I think, the executive director of the board that oversees emergency services in Minnesota. And we'll want to hold our questions until the end of these presentations. And then we have quite a number of distinguished testifiers. I think there were about 15 of them now. We're going to hear from each of them very, very briefly. And we're going to, I would ask members to hold questions until the end of all of their speaking. And so hopefully we're going to get through this in our hour and a half. I know we could spend many, many more hours on this topic, and we possibly will later on if members bring bills. But anyway, with that, I would like to call on House Research and ask to begin the presentation on the EMS system. Ms. Clarkvist.
Madam Chair, I'm just getting stuff ready here.
All right. Let me note while she's doing that, members, you have received a lot of materials for today. We're going to be doing some screen sharing to go through that, but you can always look at these later. And I do also want to mention to anyone who was not able to get on the list to testify today that we do always take written testimony. And please send that to the committee administrator. We can still take more testimony if folks would like, and he will distribute that to members of the committee. So I just wanted to make that clear. We're really very interested in everyone's perspectives on this topic. So Ms. Clarkvist, if you're ready.
Madam Chair, may I ask, is everyone seeing the slide correctly?
No, I don't think we're seeing it at all.
No, oh, shoot. Okay.
Okay, we're getting it now. There we go.
Is that good? Okay.
Yep.
All right. Madam Chair and members, I'm Elizabeth Clarkvist with House Research, and my colleague Doug Berg and I will be presenting briefly on the Emergency Medical Services Regulatory Board, its operation, its duties, and its appropriations. So the Emergency Medical Services Regulatory Board was established in 1995 to regulate ambulance services and perform other functions related to emergency medical services. The board began operations in 1996, and before that time, the Commissioner of Health regulated ambulance services and ambulance service personnel. The board is composed of 17 voting members who are appointed by the governor. And those members are listed on this slide. At least seven of these members must reside outside the seven county metro area, and they're appointed for 4-year terms. The governor designates one of the members to serve as the chair, and the board also includes two ex officio non-voting members, one representative appointed by the Speaker of the House, and one senator who's appointed by the Senate. The board is governed by Minnesota Statutes Chapter 144E, and rules adopted by the board are found in Minnesota Rules Chapter 4690. General duties of the board include licensure of ambulance services, registration of medical response units, certification of personnel, approval of education programs, and administration of grant programs. And I'll discuss each of these duties in the following slides. One duty of the board is to license ambulance services in the state. An ambulance service must be licensed in order to operate in Minnesota. Ambulance service licensure procedures are specified in statute, and it may be licensed as a basic life support, advanced life support, part-time advanced life support, or specialized life support ambulance service. And this slide briefly describes each of the types of ambulance services. For each type, statutes specify specific staffing requirements and authorized exemptions from the staffing requirements, whether the service must operate on a continuous basis in the service area or not, services they're authorized to provide, data collection requirements, and equipment ambulances are required to carry. The board is authorized to inspect ambulance services to ensure compliance with statutes and rules, and may suspend or revoke or place conditions on an ambulance services license for a violation of statutes or rules. The numbers on this slide are taken from the EMSRB's agency profile that's part of the budget materials for the 2022-23 biennial budget. And this slide shows the number of licensed ambulance services in the state, the number of ground ambulances and air ambulances operating in the state, and the number of ambulance service licenses that have been issued. Some ambulance services hold more than one license. An ambulance service may be staffed with paid personnel, with a combination of paid personnel and volunteers, or with all volunteers. And 65% of services are staffed either with all volunteers or a combination of paid personnel and volunteers. An ambulance services license specifies the ambulance services primary service area, and that's defined to mean the geographic area that can reasonably be served by the ambulance service. Air ambulances are not required to designate a primary service area. An ambulance service must have at least one mutual aid agreement with a neighboring service that can assist as needed in the primary service area when the local ambulance service cannot respond. Ambulance services serving in a rural area may also have a mutual aid agreement with a neighboring service to provide part-time support when the licensee requests it. An ambulance service may operate outside of its primary service area if requested by a transferring physician or an ambulance service licensed in that service area when the response is required to meet an individual's immediate medical need and the primary service cannot respond. The link on this slide may be used to see the primary service area for each ambulance service in the state, and the materials for each ambulance service also show when each primary service area was last revised and the counties, cities, and townships that are included in the primary service area. If an ambulance service wants to make a change to its primary service area, it must submit an application to the board and must satisfy requirements in statute to make that change. And these changes include the following. If an ambulance service wants to retract service from a geographic area, it must document that another ambulance service is providing or will provide coverage within that proposed area. If an ambulance service wants to provide service in an area that's already being covered, the ambulance service proposing the overlap must submit documentation from the service whose primary service area overlaps the expansion, approving the expansion and agreeing to withdraw from the proposed expansion area. If an ambulance service wants to provide service in a geographic area where there's no ambulance service, it must submit documentation approving that change from ambulance services surrounding the proposed expansion area. The board is also authorized to issue a temporary license to an ambulance service when a primary service area would otherwise be deprived of ambulance service coverage. The temporary license expires when a regular license is issued for an ambulance service to cover that area, and the temporary license cannot be valid for more than 6 months. In addition to licensing ambulance services, the board is also authorized to register medical response units and specialized medical response units. These are units that are either recognized by a local unit of government or recognized by an entity other than a local unit of government, and their primary responsibility is to provide initial medical care at a medical emergency before an ambulance arrives. Another board duty is certification of personnel who staff ambulance services and medical response units. So the board certifies emergency medical technicians, advanced emergency medical technicians, paramedics, community emergency medical technicians, community paramedics, and emergency medical responders. And there are specific certification requirements for each category of personnel, and the training requirements and corresponding scope of practice generally increase from EMTs to AEMTs to paramedics. Generally, to be certified as an EMT, AEMT, or paramedic, an individual is required to complete a training course sponsored by the U.S. Department of Transportation, or an equivalent, and pass the written and practical exams administered by the board or by a designee. Emergency medical responders must be certified as an emergency medical responder by a national certification organization. And for CEMTs and community paramedics, in addition to satisfying certification requirements, they must have some work experience and must complete an additional education program. Requirements for certification renewal are also specified in statute. In addition to certification, the board is responsible for investigating complaints against certified personnel and disciplining certified personnel for certain conduct. The board is also responsible for approving education programs for EMRs, EMTs, AEMTs, and paramedics. General requirements exist that govern program content, use of instructors, and the ratio of instructors to students, documentation the program must maintain, written agreements related to clinical training sites, and maintaining average yearly pass rates. Additional requirements exist for education programs for AEMTs and paramedics. The board has authority to audit education programs approved by the board and to deny, suspend, revoke, condition, or refuse to renew an education program's approval if the program does not comply with requirements in statute and rule. There are currently 191 education programs approved by the board, and requirements also exist for education program instructors and test examiners. Additionally, the board administers some grant programs that provide funds to ambulance services personnel and EMS regions in the state. And these programs include a program to provide grants to ambulance services to reimburse them for the cost of a volunteer ambulance attendance EMT education course or continuing education course. The Cooper Sams Volunteer Ambulance Program, which pays longevity awards to ambulance service personnel who are volunteers or who are paid a limited amount and who meet other requirements and statute when they complete their ambulance service career. Funding to the 8 emergency medical services regions in the state for projects to support local and regional EMS within the region. And finally, the EMS for Children program, which is a federally funded program and involves collaboration with Children's of Minnesota and funds activities and initiatives to improve emergency care for children. And now Mr. Berg will present information on the board's finances.
Madam Chair and members.
Thank you, Mr. Berg, go ahead.
Madam Chair and members, I'm Doug Berg. I'm a fiscal analyst for the committee. And just very briefly, a couple slides on the board's base budget. These slides are on the agency's base as we go into the 22-23 fiscal biennium. That's the 2-year period that begins the coming July 1st of 2021, July 1st of this year, and runs through June 30th of 2023. That's the budget that the governor's recommendation will come out on tomorrow, and for which the legislature will adopt a budget before the end of the 21 regular legislative session. If you look at the top, the all funds base for the Emergency Medical Services Regulatory Board for the biennium is $10.5 million. And it's fairly straightforward. And you see that is in, from a fund perspective, it comes in 4 pieces. One of those pieces, the general fund piece, is 72% of the budget. That's a total of about $7.6 almost million dollars on a biennial basis. That is the piece which the legislature directly appropriates. And so that will be the amount that the legislature decides to appropriate for the board's general fund costs. That's the piece. You see that there are other smaller pieces that are dedicated revenues, statutory appropriations or grants from the 9/11 emergency fund, which is 13% of the board's budget, and which is about $1.4 million on a biennial basis. Federal funds that are about $260,000 on a biennial basis, and restricted special revenue, dedicated revenue, that is 12% of the board's budget, which is about $1.3 million on a biennial basis. Next slide. And this slide just looks at the general fund base budget. Again, that larger chunk from the last one, the piece that the legislature directly appropriates, and looks at it by programmatically where it's spent. And you'll see the largest piece of it is for EMSRB board operations. This includes grants under, that go out to the regions under 144E50. But then there is also, when you look at the appropriation, there are sub categories reserved of the general fund amount for the Cooper Sams Longevity Awards, which is in the upper left-hand section of this, which is 23% of the general fund appropriation. Ambulance training grants, which are 10% of the general fund money the state appropriates. And then the EMS regional grants that are 15%, and then there's administration for the Cooper Sams Longevity Program. You might note that I mentioned regional grants twice. There are regional grants, the 15% that are identified specifically in the appropriation in the budget bill. There's also grants that go to regions under Chapter 144E.50 that in this display appear as part of the EMSRB operations appropriation. I'll note there's another handout posted on the website that looks at essentially the same data in a spreadsheet format. I'm not going to go through that because it's pretty much the same data, but that in a nutshell is the board budget, Madam Chair and members.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Berg, and thank you, Ms. Clark-Vista. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, good. Very good. Thank you. All right. Well, that's, we appreciate that. I just want to emphasize again, we are not hearing the board's budget right now. This is not, that would be in a different setting, a different time. This is just a basic overview for members to understand what the board does and what's involved. And I think we can all see that the board has quite a few responsibilities and things to juggle. So with that, I'm going to ask Mr. Spector, who is the executive director of the board that we were just discussing, to give us a brief presentation and fill in any gaps that you might see are needed, Mr. Spector, and welcome to the committee. Please just introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair Liebling and members of the committee. My name is Tony Spector, and I'm the executive director of the EMS Regulatory Board. One caveat, I have a 9-year-old and an almost 11-year-old who are doing schoolwork at home until they go back to school tomorrow, or next week rather, so there may be a slight chance I'm interrupted. I'll do my best to have those interruptions down to a minimum. And thank you for doing your homework. Now, Daddy needs to talk. Thank you. Having said that, I very much appreciate the opportunity to present before this committee. When I was asked to appear, I was asked to talk about the state of EMS and in Minnesota, as well as my opinion on challenges, opportunities. And I appreciate those questions. We could be here for a few hours if I was going to speak on the state of EMS in Minnesota. So I'll keep my comments narrow and also let the committee know that I speak on behalf of the board. And so my opinions, if you will, or comments as it relates to challenges and opportunities will be those that were articulated by the board. It was a very nice overview of the EMSRB in terms of its statutory duties and responsibilities. I'd like to highlight just a couple of those points. One of the questions I was, I think, asked prior to is, again, the state of the state, how are we doing with EMS in Minnesota? And I would say overall good. Now, that is a, I know that's the board's position. That's a subjective term, but let me amplify that and fill in the gaps there. As everyone knows, we are in the midst of COVID, and the EMSRB has certain duties according to the Minnesota Emergency Operations Plan. And we've been working with our partners at the State Emergency Operations Center, the Homeland Security Emergency Management. One of those responsibilities has been to ensure that ambulance services throughout Minnesota receive the proper personal protective equipment, or PPE. And we've been working diligently to do that. We've also been working with our 8 EMS regional partners. Now, the budget presentation indicated that we provide funding to the 8 EMS regions, and we do so. We work collaboratively and in partnership with them. And we do so for several reasons. They are, in many respects, the eyes and ears, and they have a really good pulse on what's going on in their aspect or part of the state. And where that comes into play are some of the challenges we're seeing with EMS. And these aren't just necessarily challenges in the state of Minnesota, but these are challenges nationwide. I'd like to highlight just a couple of those for the committee. One such challenge is recruitment and retention in rural Minnesota. EMS, if we look at the history, the brief history of EMS from when the board started, which also predated the board, there were a lot of volunteer ambulance services in greater Minnesota. And the population bases have shifted. Some of these towns have become smaller. The population has become aged. And we're not necessarily seeing volunteerism in EMS like we saw, like it used to be. And moreover, volunteerism around the country on a variety of areas is challenging. We're seeing 2 families that are working now, 2-parent households that work. We have kids involved in multiple sports, and the competing challenges of trying to volunteer, it is a challenge. And another opportunity for EMS is that we have endeavored to become a more educated industry and actually transition from a profession. And we have adopted national education standards and requiring that our folks that we credential, our EMS, our EMTs, our AEMTs, and our paramedics maintain a higher level of education, EMS education. Tough thing to do when we're asking volunteers to volunteer. But yet our goal is to have the social contract, if you will. Someone dials 911 and their expectation is a competently trained law enforcement officer, professionally trained, or a firefighter, or an EMS personnel will arrive on scene and deliver the best possible care in the shortest period of time. And so there are some challenges with that. Recognizing those challenges, the EMSRB has also recognized that part of the EMS care system isn't just ambulance services. One of the handouts that I had provided looks at the number of folks we credential in the state by credential type. And you'll see that the EMR is about half of food credential. That's the lowest level credential, and that's most common for fire services in Greater Minnesota, rescue squads in Greater Minnesota, and law enforcement agencies in Greater Minnesota. And that's important because it can take a chunk of time to get an ambulance out the door when we're talking about a volunteer crew that has to be paged out and respond to the ambulance hall, get the truck, and then respond on the call. In contrast, when we have law enforcement officers on duty, if they maintain a level of certification or registration in this case and have the tools and the tactics or the education rather, these are the folks that are saving lives and the ambulances are transporting the lives saved. So it's important that we remember that law enforcement officers and firefighters and rescue squads are part of the EMS care continuum. When we look at in rural Minnesota, the challenges. One of the slides that I've provided for this group is the call volume for the Renville Ambulance Service. The Renville Ambulance Service is located, it's a small town in Renville County, and they recently approached the EMSRB and said that they wish to surrender their license because of the challenges associated with staffing their service. I believe that their run volume last year was 176 or 178, the slide is there. But we look at that, and that is approximately one run every couple days. And if we look at one run every couple days, and we look at the revenue that a service is generating, and to be clear, the EMSRB does not get involved in revenue generation or the revenues of ambulance services, not our jurisdiction, but we're aware of it. And the challenge of sustaining that service is significant. Because at the end of the day, who's going to pay for that? And so that is part of the challenges we're looking at. How do we maintain that level of service in Greater Minnesota? How do we assist these rural services? And what's that model that we're going to be looking at on a go-forward basis? We are delighted to be part of that discussion in terms of trying to problem solve and fix. But at the end of the day, it's not something that is specific to the EMSRB to solve. We're delighted to work with our stakeholders and our partners, with the Minnesota Department of Health and the Minnesota Ambulance Association and others to do so collaboratively. But it's going to require a hard look at how folks are doing business in Greater Minnesota and what that model is on a go-forward basis in the future. So we're looking forward to just solving those problems and those challenges. And getting back on the education piece, when we're asking volunteers to volunteer, and we say to them, in order to start volunteering, you have to complete 150 or 160-hour education program, or you have to complete 40 or 50 or 60 hours of education every 2 years. That can be an additional burden or additional challenge on volunteers. So when we look forward to, when we move forward on staffing models, that's going to be something that we need to consider. How do we resolve those? But with challenges are opportunities, and we have an engaged board. We have very competent and professional staff that continue to work with services to try to get to where they need to be. One of the things that the MSRB does, we partner with other stakeholders, is we provide, conduct what are called rural ambulance assessments, where we bring subject matter experts to bear to an ambulance service and help with a top-to-down assessment on what's working and what are some of the developmental opportunities and how do we implement those developmental opportunities. So with the mission of protecting the public's health and safety through regulation and support of the EMS system, that's one of the aspects that we look at doing. In addition to our regulatory roles, how do we help folks maintain or obtain and maintain compliance, and how do we make them successful so when that call for service is placed to 911, that we know that it's a competent police car, law enforcement officer rather, fire service, and an ambulance service that shows up. So, and I think that I've approached my time window, Chair, so I will stop at this point and stand, or in this case, sit for questions.
Well, wonderful. Thank you very much, Mr. Spector. We really appreciate it. And I'm going to go now to Diogo Reese from DHS, and he's going to talk just a little bit about the other part of the funding picture for EMS, and then we'll take member questions on the presentations if there are any brief questions before we go to our wonderful array of testifiers. So, Mr. Reese, please.
Hi, good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Diogo Hayes with the Department of Human Services, where I work as the Rate and Policy Manager for Medicaid and Minnesota Care. I was asked today to speak briefly about what the coverage for emergency services are in the Medicaid program, so that's where I'll start. We do obviously cover emergency services by ambulances in the program, and we do so in both the medical assistance and Minnesota Care programs, consistent coverage throughout both of those programs. There was some mention earlier about emergency and non-emergency ambulance services, which we also cover in the program depending on the need of the patient. Additionally, we also cover inter-facility transfer. So that's, think of this as you present maybe for an emergency at one facility and then you maybe need a level of care that isn't available at that facility. Assuming that's the case, we would pay for transportation by an ambulance if that's the need of the individual so that they can be transported to a facility that can certainly meet their medical needs. And then also, we also cover ambulance services via air, which we do obviously in emergency situations, but also we cover them for out-of-state transports when individuals are in need of some surgical procedures, usually that can't be found within the state. So pretty comprehensive benefit as far as emergency ambulance services goes. If you go to the next slide, please. We do pay, there were some questions about utilization, so I have this data here to show you. Just a quick disclaimer to say that you can see the green line is 2020 data, the blue line is 2019 data. So quick disclaimer to say that the data is not fully complete for 2020 yet, as it's still pretty early into 2021, and so we need some time for the data to play out. But I did get kind of a temporary snapshot. You can see here that the utilization before March, April, May, when COVID first started, has been up, you know, about the same or following a similar trend line that we saw in 2019. So there was certainly a pretty big drop in March, April, May, but it sort of equalized after that and is following a similar trend line. So throughout the years, we pay somewhere between 12,000 and 14,000 claims a year for emergency ambulance services, which in 2018 totaled about $109 million, and 2019, calendar year 2019, totaled about $111 million. With that, I can stand for any questions, but just a real brief overview of the services we provide in the Medicaid program.
Well, that's great. Thank you for that. So if members have any brief clarifying questions, and again, I don't want to get into a debate or a big discussion here on what's been presented, but if anyone is needing clarification before we go on to our testifiers, we could entertain those now. And I'm not seeing any questions. Okay, so we will then go on to our testifiers. And as we do that, I just would like to repeat, first of all, thank you very much to all who have been willing to come and testify to us today. And for those who also offered testimony, but we weren't able to accommodate because we can only take so many people in our limited time, but we are very interested in what you all have to say. We do have to ask each of you to be restricted to 2 minutes. And again, we realize that that is a completely inadequate for any real discussion of the issues that you might be bringing before us. But what I'm hoping we'll get is kind of a a good flavor of some of the where all of you work, what your role is in the system, and some of whatever comments you wish to share with us today. So with that, we're going to start with Kevin Miller. And if you would just start by just stating your name and who you're representing, and then go ahead with your 2-minute testimony. Mr. Miller.
Thank you, Chair Liebling, Vice Chair Hewitt, members of the committee. My name is Kevin Miller. I am the acting chair of the Emergency Medical Services Regulatory Board and legislative work group chair for the past 6 years. My comments today will center on the EMSRB's ability to help facilitate legislative changes. Frankly, this has been very difficult, partly due to staff size, bandwidth, and acumen to facilitate such changes. So thank you, Representative Hewitt, for your assistance and commitment here. Considering over 300 licensed agencies, over 28,000 providers, today all the work is done through 12 FTEs. Staff reductions have occurred over the years due to budget restrictions. We have a cleanup bill that has been patiently waiting for the past 3 years, and we'd like to see that get to the goal line. And with the members in this committee, we can do that. But more so than the cleanup bill, 144E, which began in the 90s, and there has been some changes. It has not kept up with the scope or demand of change driven by medicine and technology. Consider the scope and change of an EMT or paramedic today compared to 20 years ago. Our work is evidence-based. Advances are driven by outcomes. Paramedics perform highly advanced procedures. Aggressive management directly impact patient outcome. Minnesota enjoys some of the best pre-hospital outcomes in the country. We have fantastic physician leadership that wants to lead and ensure EMS agencies are performing at the highest level. However, with such great advances, regulatory oversight in these areas has not kept up. For example, sentinel events are not a mandatory requirement of reporting, such as a death or a harm of a patient or a crew in a crash involving an ambulance, death or harm of a patient due to a medication error or a procedural error. Rules under 4690 have become antiquated. Some are not even enforceable, and some are actually barriers to patient care. This, in conjunction with 144E, must be updated and kept current. We need the resources and legislative support to continue solid regulatory oversight. To conclude, as we consider the future of EMS in Minnesota, listen to the EMSRB's mission statement to protect the public's health and safety through regulation and support of the EMS system. Madam Chair, we need to make changes. We need your support, and we can build on the great work done to date. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Miller, and thank you for sticking to the timeline as well, setting a good example for all the people that follow you. We appreciate it. Mr. McAlpin, please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Buck McAlpin. I've been involved with emergency services about 35 years. I'm on today representing the Minnesota Ambulance Association. I've done government relations for them for over about half that time. Thanks again for having this overview today, and I think the speakers before us have already done a great point. There's few of us on this screen that have been involved when we formed the EMS Regulatory Board back in the early 90s, and to Mr. Miller's comment, it was a very physician-driven conversation, and I believe our state EMS medical directors today can play an important role about what the ambulance industry looks like in the future. But I think a couple things is, first, thanks to the Minnesota legislature. The reason why our industry does function today, although there's some things we can work on, is because the help, and I can list a mile long this legislature has done to support us financially and with programmatic dollars and tax exemptions and things like that. You'll find the ambulance industry today, when they speak, I believe, is a pretty humble group. We usually come to the legislature when there's things that we need. And I think at this point, especially in rural Minnesota, you'll probably hear the word crisis. The Ambulance Association's looked at that, and we have work groups, rural sustainability groups, that work on that issue. That's a big part of what we need to work on. And Mr. Reese's comment on the funding piece and what we've seen is, Mark Jones will speak later from Rural Health. We've witnessed about a $48 million impact financially over the last 12 months to the ambulance industry from COVID. We still have metro providers that have seen close to a 25% reduction in ambulance volume, folks staying in nursing homes, our community paramedics offering different types of care. So it's a great time and opportunity to talk about what some of that care looks like in the future. And most importantly, Medicare and Medicaid, which is 70 or 80% of rural Minnesota's payer mix, pays well below the cost of that. So we appreciate the opportunity today, Madam Chair and members, and look forward to working on anything that we can do. And we do plan to have some ideas we want to bring forward.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Mr. McAlpin. Dr. Peterson.
Madam Chair and committee members, thanks for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Bjorn Peterson. I am an emergency physician and EMS medical director with Regents Hospital in St. Paul. And I'm speaking to you today in my role as president of the Minnesota chapter of the National Association of EMS Physicians. Our organization represents both physician and non-physician members and is active in promoting research, legislation, and quality standards within EMS. The previous two speakers mentioned this, and I'd like to take my time to expand a little bit on the importance of local physician medical director involvement. The importance of this was first officially recognized 25 years ago with the publication of the EMS Agenda for the Future, which was a joint position statement between the National Association of EMS Physicians and the National Highway and Traffic Safety Administration. Physician oversight has also been recognized throughout state and federal policy and legislation as a key component of a high-functioning EMS system. And today, the larger House of Medicine has acknowledged the unique body of clinical knowledge and expertise required to practice EMS medicine. This has led to the recognition of emergency medical services as a board-certifiable subspecialty of emergency medicine. And here in Minnesota, we boast three EMS physician fellowship training programs, which have trained EMS physicians who practice across the country today. We have a long history of active physician involvement in the Minnesota EMS system, evidenced by broad participation in the EMSRB Medical Director Standing Advisory Committee, the leadership of the state EMS medical director, my colleague, Dr. Aaron Burnett, the prevalence of board certified EMS physicians, and I would say most importantly, a culture that values the autonomy of the local medical director. This culture has led to research breakthroughs and innovative emergency treatments in areas such as airway management, advanced CPR techniques, the use of ECMO in cardiac arrest, the optimal treatment of severe head injuries, the use of ultrasound, and we could go on and on with many other topics. And as EMS evolves with new response models, treatments, paradigms, and reimbursement models, such as a CMS ET3 pilot, we must continue to encourage physician involvement and possibly even mandate physician involvement and high standards of care as a critical part of our public safety and healthcare system. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Martin Shearer.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Martin Shearer. I'm the EMS chief for Hennepin EMS. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today. So I've been with Hennepin EMS for about a year and a half, but I've been in the paramedic business for about 30 years. I've also consulted with the Cook Ambulance Service up in northern Minnesota, which is kind of where my cabin is. So I have a great interest in how they do up there. So Hennepin EMS, a very busy urban, suburban, even some rural service. We cover a large part of Hennepin County and most of the city of Minneapolis. We serve with our partners, Alliant, North Memorial, Ridgeview Medical Center, Edina Fire, and we adhere to all the same authorities as the EMSRB, the Minnesota Department of Health, Hennepin County Public Health, and the West Metro EMS Council. And as EMS moves forward, we are really focusing on a system-based improvements to achieve meaningful and lasting change. The care that EMS provides is incredibly important. We appreciate the gravity of the service we provide, and we also respect the responsibility that we have to the residents of Minnesota. And we take the health and safety of our state very seriously. We also appreciate that we're given a great privilege to care for all the people, wherever they are, wherever they may be, anytime, day or night, or in any weather. And Hennepin is a kind of a different service, and we'd like to highlight the many layers of social, economic diversity and the many varied cultures that we have within our PSA. It's one of the things that makes our job really interesting. We go from an accident on the highway to a mansion on the shore of Lake Minnetonka to some dark alley or just some tent. We feel that we really truly do get an unfiltered window into the humanity and the way of life that few others do. So what we'd like you to consider today is that we are part of a much larger ecosystem, and these are not EMS only issues, and some of our most challenging issues that we face are related to poverty, a lack of mental health care, addiction, and homelessness. So our recommendation to the committee is that we consider investing in additional mental health care and addiction care. This is both a mental health and a safety issue for the patients and our paramedics. And we invest in to support the service and the people that are experiencing homelessness. And we also would recommend supporting of the EMSRB. One great way to figure this all out is that we invite you to ride along with us and to spend a few hours some evening and experience some of the challenges that EMS faces every day. We've been doing these ride-alongs with our leadership and other members of the legislature for a few months now, and the reviews have come back very, very positive. This is an extremely valuable experience and to give the riders a brand new perspective of how EMS works and the issues face. So I'd invite you to contact me or Susie Emmert, our policy advocate at Hamilton Healthcare, and get ready for a very positive experience with us. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Shearer. I see that Chair Liebling got dropped from the call. She'll be back, I hope. I'm going to introduce our next presenter, testifier, and that is Brian Edwards, the Emergency Medical Services. He's the chief at Northfield Hospital and Clinics. Welcome to the committee, and please proceed, Mr. Edwards.
Thank you. First, I have to do a mic check to make sure you can hear me.
We can hear you.
Great. Thank you. Madam Chair and members, thank you for allowing me the opportunity to speak to you today. My name is Brian Edwards. I am the EMS Chief for Northfield Hospital and Clinics. I want to talk to you today about two of the strengths of Minnesota EMS, as well as the downside of those strengths. First, the people of Minnesota EMS systems are our greatest strength. The backbone of EMS is made up of hardworking, dedicated, selfless individuals who work as a team to deliver excellent care to the people of this great state. These professionals, some paid and some not, respond in all extremes of weather and sometimes in the face of overwhelming adversity, like COVID, to make sure that our family and friends have the best chance of survival. Another strength is that the local system medical director has the authority to set policies and standards for training, equipment, quality, and patient care. Generally, local control remains with those who serve and those who benefit from that service. This philosophy is codified in statute and has worked very well for many years. However, there are some things we could do better. Adequate staffing is a problem for nearly every system in the state, both career and volunteer. People are leaving EMS and not being replaced at a pace that keeps up with demand. The most common reasons given: competing life demands for volunteers, increased licensure requirements, low pay, and the physical and emotional toll on the human body. If Minnesota wants the essential service that EMS provides, systems must be adequately funded, alternative response models should be considered, and we must be ready to care for our caregivers. Lastly, the local control I spoke about is limited. Even though the medical director sets operational standards, true performance measures may be lacking in some areas. Current statutes permit the state to set licensing and operational standards, but not performance standards. Localities that are dissatisfied with their EMS provider oftentimes have limited options to seek remedy. Even though the current primary service area laws in the state are solid and ensure access to care for every person in the state, they may be standing in the way of improvements to care. We must figure out the best way to preserve access to care while at the same time making sure that that care meets industry-defined standards. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Edwards. Our next testifier is Joshua Howell, Vice President of Strategy and Business Optimization at LifeLink 3. So, Mr. Howell, if you are ready, welcome to the committee and please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chairperson. Members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Josh Howell, VP of Strategy and Business Optimization for LifeLink 3. LifeLink 3 is the largest air medical consortium in the United States, born right here in Minnesota in 1985, a true illustration of the type of collaboration that occurs in the state of Minnesota, something we're very proud of in terms of the rich history we provided. We are now 10 health systems strong, 8 of those in Minnesota, representing over 70 individual hospitals. And growing. Committee members, I'm happy to report, as some of my colleagues have said, we believe that the state of air medical services in the state of Minnesota is strong. 2020 was an interesting year indeed, and I saw maybe the strongest levels of cooperation, collaboration, coordination between air medical services than I've seen since I arrived in 2015. From the civil unrest, some of the decisions that were made at the Minnesota Air Medical Council related to aerial safety last summer, to the ongoing response to the COVID pandemic. So very proud of the progress that we're making as a system. One thing 2020 did remind us was how we are not only an extension of our member owner health systems, but also an extension of the strong ground EMS, public safety, law enforcement agencies that make up a much larger system. So we as some have said, look forward to the opportunity to continue collaborating. A big focus for us is the alignment and the integration of our services, our expertise within the larger system, and ultimately with the hospital and health systems as it applies to the overall patient experience. So again, thank you for your time. Look forward to partnering with you all.
Very good. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Howell. Next up is Dr. John Pate.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman and distinguished members of the board. Can you hear me okay? Okay. I'm John Pate. I'm a family practice physician here in Wadena, Minnesota. I'm a member of the EMSRB. I've been the medical director at Tri-County Hospital EMS for the last 25 years. I also work with two basic life support ambulance squads in the local region in West Central Minnesota. I would note that our services serve two of the poorest communities in the state of Minnesota. Each of the three services that I've had the pleasure to work with over the last 25 years at one time or another has faced severe manpower shortages. These have been dealt with in different ways. The basic life support services have changed their recruiting. They've gone from a volunteer to, this is a part-time job for you. They have worked with their primary service area municipalities, and they have been able to make ground on reimbursement. And this reimbursement has helped them to improve their pay for on-call time, for 911 call time, for training and also retention, although their pay is still pretty low. In our ALS service, the salaries are lower than they are in the metro, but our hospital at least is able to contribute into health insurance coverage and also 401ks. I would like to point out that on all three of my services, there are members of these services who are working in two different ambulance services, in effect, having two EMS jobs because of the low pay in order to be able to properly support their families. What do we need in West Central Minnesota? First, we need the EMSRB as a resource to be out there to be able to help us. The knowledge of this organization and the effectiveness of its function has improved every single year that I've been associated with it, and it has really reached a peak at this point. But we also need more money. We need money to help shore up the Cooper Sam retirement program and make it more comparable to that that is given to the fire services. We need more money for underpaid EMS managers, for paid crews that are paid low wages, and for building and training. We greatly appreciate the services that the EMSRB has helped us with over the years, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Pate. We appreciate it. Next up is Jill Warrett, if I'm saying it right. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. Thank you for allowing me to testify today. My name is Jill Warrett. I am the Executive Director of the Metropolitan Emergency Services Board, and we house Metro Region EMS, which is one of the eight EMS regions in the state. Today, I'm here representing all eight regions. EMS regions are funded via the EMSRB from the EMS Support Act and the EMS Relief Account, which funds are derived from seatbelt fines. The amount of funds the EMS regions receive has been in decline for many years, while demands on the regions themselves have been increasing. I will note that previously increases to the EMS Support Act have passed in 2017 and 2019 only to fall out during the conference committees. So we will still be seeking additional funding via the EMS Support Act. The EMS regions have seven statutory obligations, though each region meets those obligations differently, depending upon the region's needs, demographics, and resources. One of the primary functions of the EMS regions is training for EMS and first responder personnel. The training needs, again, vary by region, As was noted earlier, particularly with Mr. Spector, there are many areas in Greater Minnesota which are served by volunteer first responder organizations prior to EMS arrival. However, in the metro, while law and fire may often get to calls first, EMS is often close behind, though we don't generally have volunteer EMS response agencies. I'll just note that the regions, while they do work independently of one another, they also come together and work cooperatively on statewide plans, teams, and events. And I won't spend any more time on things. I will note that both Mr. Spector and previous testifiers today have highlighted the issues with EMS recruitment. That is a very real issue, and I'm sure you will continue to hear about that. Thank you very much for your time.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. Next up is Mark Jones. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members, thank you for the opportunity to address you this afternoon. My name is Mark Jones. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Rural Health Association. I've also worked as an EMT for a rural ambulance service for over 20 years. The sustainability of EMS is of high importance to rural communities. EMS staff are our first providers of healthcare. They play an important role as patients move through the healthcare system. Without them, the system just does not work. The struggles of rural EMS are real. The issues working against sustainability are quite evident. In 2002, the Minnesota Department of Health released a report titled A Quiet Crisis, Minnesota's Rural Ambulance Services at Risk. This report identified recruitment and retention, along with financial and reimbursement issues, as the top challenge. This report described the state of rural EMS as in crisis. In 2015, rural EMS leaders and stakeholders convened to share their visions. Again, workforce and funding rose to the top, along with leadership. Most recently, in 2016, MDH conducted a survey of rural EMS managers. Again, workforce, financial management, and leadership were identified as issues. A report generated from the 2015 meeting included the following recommendation. The challenges faced by rural EMS can be mitigated by assisting rural communities with evaluating the reliability and sustainability of their current EMS operations and understanding what constitutes a sustainable model and providing expert guidance and support to these communities in working through the process of moving from unsustainable to sustainable models. Madam Chair, members, the time to talk about rural EMS challenges is behind us. The time to act is now. Support for local solutions is critical. Each community must have access to the tools, resources, and support needed to lead their sustainability efforts. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Jones. Next up is Randy Fisher.
Good afternoon. Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to address your committee today. My name is Randy Fisher, and I'm a paramedic and have served in Minnesota EMS for 42 years, all of it in rural Minnesota. I've spent my career managing and operating county-owned, hospital-owned, and private-owned ambulance services with both volunteer and paid personnel. I also served on the Commissioner of Health's EMS Advisory Task Force in the late 1980s, along with an appointment to the MDH EMS Advisory Council in 2000. Ambulance services, as you've heard, are facing numerous financial challenges. Decreased revenue from low or no reimbursement, increased costs of supplies and operations, and struggling to find qualified personnel. We have done numerous studies on the EMS recruitment and retention crisis in Minnesota. Often the discussion leads to how do we recruit and retain volunteers. To me, it's not a question of how do we maintain and get more people to volunteer. It's a question of how do we get better reimbursement and direct financial support to ambulance services to enable them to maintain emergency 911 services and recruit personnel. EMS is a profession with an unbelievable medical technology and advances provided by incredible, committed, and dedicated volunteers and paid ambulance personnel. If we create a mechanism for direct financial support, that would enable ambulance services to sustain EMS and aid in solving the recruiting and retention crisis we have been facing for years. Most ambulance services in the state are operating at less than full staffing of ambulances in their communities because of the shortage of personnel. Medicaid and Medicare reimbursement is well below the cost of response and care. No transport calls require no reimbursement, and a growing ledger of uncompensated calls are reducing our ability to sustain EMS in our communities. Establishing a state funding with direct support to all licensed 911 transporting services will aid in solving this crisis. For my service, without the assistance that we receive from COVID relief and the PPP program and local grants, we likely would not have been able to survive 2020 financially. I believe we need to improve Medicaid reimbursement and establish an ongoing state local funding mechanism with direct support to our rural services to keep the doors open and to strengthen 911 ambulance response capabilities. This will also help solve the EMS recruitment and retention challenges in Minnesota and provide financial support to sustain ambulance 911 readiness. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for your testimony, Mr. Fisher. Next, BJ Jungman, if I said it right, welcome.
That's correct, thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. Thank you for taking my testimony today as you delve into the state of EMS in Minnesota. My name is BJ Jungman. I'm the fire chief for the City of Burnsville Fire Department. I am here today on behalf of the Minnesota Fire Chiefs Association, which represents the leadership of the Minnesota Fire Service. On behalf of the Fire Service leaders of Minnesota, we greatly appreciate the legislature for recognizing the need to reform our emergency medical services legislation. We believe the current legislation is not currently serving the citizens of Minnesota as well as EMS systems in other states. We believe the current regulation does not serve the citizens of Minnesota as well as it could. There are many concerns amongst the fire service around the current state of EMS in Minnesota. These concerns, the current regulatory environment that was awarded, that awards monopolies to ambulance services and was established in the early 1980s. These ambulance license monopolies have little to no oversight on their performance, reliability, or billing practices. There are also concerns over the hospital destinations of unknowing patients who trust their EMS professionals to guide them, which has in turn created referral patterns for healthcare systems instead of bringing patients to the closest appropriate facility. A lot has changed since the inception of the current regulation. The EMS profession has progressed significantly to provide critical care in the field. Communities and demand for service have also significantly changed, yet those communities have no ability to have input on the provision of the ambulance service in their community, and their citizens have no choice in the ambulance service that provides care when they call 911. The lay citizen does not know or understand the EMS system to, in order to advocate for a better service in their community. They assume that the best possible service is being provided. Communities have input on the other two legs of public safety, both police and fire, who service their community. This has left communities with little to no options other than to tax their local law enforcement or fire service to fill the void. This further challenges a primarily volunteer fire service in Minnesota. Just like the fire service, EMS is having challenges with its recruitment and retention, and this is both in the volunteer and career ranks. This is an issue. It's not a greater Minnesota or metro issue. This is a statewide issue. We really appreciate the committee taking time to dig into the current state of EMS in Minnesota. We have many more stakeholders who wish to weigh in on this topic, and we look forward to spending more time digging into this issue to ensure that Minnesotans are provided with a high level of professional EMS service across the state. We look forward to working with you, all of you, more. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony, Mr. Jungman. Next, we have Alan Lewis. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. Chair Liebling, Vice Chair Hewitt, committee members, thank you for this opportunity to address an EMS system that in greater Minnesota is on life support. My name is Alan Lewis, and I'm the Fire Chief and Emergency Manager for Virginia, Minnesota. I'm also an adjunct professor at Columbia Southern University, where I teach EMS administration courses in the College of Safety and Emergency Services. As a fire chief in a career department with a 17 square mile city and an ambulance service with a 640 square mile primary service area, I have extensive experience and firsthand knowledge of the challenges currently faced in the delivery of emergency medical care in greater Minnesota. To be blunt, the EMS delivery service in much greater Minnesota is broken. There are numerous career, volunteer, and paid on-call personnel who are working tirelessly every day just to staff an ambulance for the next call and to find coverage for the next shift. These quiet professionals and grossly undercompensated public servants are doing their best to maintain a basic service level that many times just does not keep up. The current response model is no longer efficient, equitable, or sustainable. I can cite multiple examples, yet right now I have time for only one. A paid-on-call ambulance service in northern St. Louis County has struggled with staffing for over 3 years and has continuously missed ambulance calls, requiring frequent mutual aid coverage from surrounding services. The ambulance was called 179 times to EMS calls last year. 47 calls, or 26% of these, were not responded to by the basic level ambulance service licensed by the MSRB for this area. For 47 patients affected by this ambulance's inability to respond, this meant an average call time increased from the arrival of the ambulance to 22 minutes and 29 seconds, and the 90th percentile of these responses increased to 28 minutes and 16 seconds. Just over a year ago, this ambulance service was dispatched to a gentleman who collapsed while shoveling snow. They were paged three times over a five-minute period with no response. A second ambulance over 11 miles away was paged to respond as well. A police officer arrived first on scene and began CPR until the neighboring ambulance service arrived, 14 minutes and 18 seconds after the 911 call was placed. The patient did not survive. Current data collection methods utilized by MnSTAR are flawed because they often do not capture the time of the initial 911 call. Receipt of the call by 911 is not accurately tracked or reported by many agencies to MnSTAR. Data currently is analyzed most frequently beginning with the time the service was paged, which is misleading. The additional 2 to 3 minutes beyond the NFPA 1221 standard of 64 seconds to the 90th percentile when dispatching a call is significant, both to the patient who is not breathing and from a system analysis standpoint. According to a recent study conducted by McGrath Consulting, the St. Louis County Dispatch Center had a 90th percentile EMS call processing time of 2 minutes and 45 seconds. This is 157% over the standard of 64 seconds. There are multiple points of failures in the current pre-hospital emergency medical system, which in its current form is not sustainable. Chair Labling, Vice Chair Hewitt, committee members, thank you for your time this afternoon. Thank you for listening.
Thank you very much, Mr. Lewis. We appreciate your testimony today. Mike Dovish.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Mike Dovish, and I'm the newly appointed fire chief for the city of Richfield. I've been in this position for a whole 2 weeks now. However, I have been part of this conversation for a good part of the last 12 years, basically since the first responder reimbursement days. In Richfield, our residents benefit from quick response by our EMTs, who are highly trained, incredibly experienced with the number of calls that we go on per year, and highly equipped to provide service at a very high level. I don't necessarily want to provide transport services for my community. However, I would like to have our city officials at least have a say in how that service is delivered. In the past, the Richfield Fire Department has suffered from extended wait times while on scene with very critical patients, much like Chief Lewis was just mentioning. And there was nothing that we could do about that. We were simply along for the ride. To me, local control is about engaging the stakeholders in the discussions that impact the communities we serve. And right now, even if my city council directed me to improve our advanced life support call times, my only hope is that our provider might put another rig in service and help us out. But that's not my decision. That's the decision of our EMS provider. Like many of the speakers before me, talking about collaboration, meaningful and lasting change, I just want a seat at the table. I want to be able to have those conversations as a stakeholder and make sure that we're focused on the mission of keeping the residents in Richfield safe. Madam Chair and committee members, thank you for your time. I appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you very much, and congratulations on your new position.
Thank you.
Mr. Swenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I want to thank all of you for the opportunity to speak on this very important matter today. And coming up on the end of the 14 speakers here, I really can't introduce anything new in terms of what's been shared, other than to just reiterate what some of the previous speakers have said, and that is the importance of local control. Our police and fire agencies play a vital role in the delivery of emergency medical services from the examples that were given earlier, and yet currently have no voice in terms of how those services are provided within their communities. And I think as we look at legislation around emergency medical services, that is certainly something that is vitally important and needs to ensure that we can continue to provide the high level of care that our residents have grown accustomed to. And I look forward to participating in those conversations in the future as you work through this matter. And so thank you for the opportunity.
Well, thank you very much. Really appreciate all of the testifiers. And we have 15 minutes left in this hearing. I don't see any questions from members yet. And what I would like to do, well, first of all, I just really do want to express my appreciation for all the testifiers. And in general, I know that all members join me in thanking the people who do this really challenging work, whether professionals or volunteers, especially those volunteers, though. It just is just an amazing kind of public service that people are engaged in this profession, broadly speaking. I would, since we have just a few minutes left, I would like to allow our two EMS professionals who are members of this committee to have a moment to say a few words. And I wonder if Representative Backer, are you there? I don't see him on my screen, but Representative Backer, there he is. I wonder if you would like a moment to make a few comments. We just now have 14 minutes left in the hearing, but love to hear a little bit from you and then from Representative Hewitt.
Yes, thank you, Chair. And Representative Hewitt and I have been working on this for quite some time with a number of the stakeholders that have presented here today. Just to give a little background myself, I am entering my 26th year this coming June as a volunteer EMT. And this weekend had an ambulance run with a drug overdose. So I'm one of those guys that do hands-on and so forth, like several of our presenters. Much like we are looking for a solution, as I've heard, and instead of pointing fingers at other people, basically from what we've, no one's been pointing fingers here, but excuse me, I had to shut off my heater there. But we just like everybody else, Representative Hoot and I, we want to find a solution. I'm very familiar with the greater Minnesota situation with, in the summertime, it is not uncommon that I'm putting in 400 hours of call time. Basically, when I'm back here in St. Paul, from St. Paul, I'm on call. So it's something that we have to continue to work with. There's some good ideas that we will be moving forward with retention. That is my primary concern. I've learned some things about the metro area. The one gentleman talking about that slow service time. We cannot allow that to continue to happen. As one of the presenters say is when people dial 911, it is extremely important that a rig moves out of the garage. And so that is what I'm committed to. And I'm committed that when I'm able to step down that the service that I am on, which covers covers parts of three counties, two states, and also Sisseton-Wahpeton Tribe, part of them, which is about a 900 square mile area, we will be able to continue that service. Because right now, we have four EMTs and then four first responders who are taking that call time 24/7. And so I'm very much committed to this. And I do appreciate you, Chair, allowing this presentation, because as one gentleman said earlier, this starts our care for individuals. And we have so much to be proud of. We heard about the helicopter, unique, the largest one here in the country. We can do a lot of good things as we continue to work. There's been good things done, but we are at a critical point, especially in greater Minnesota. And I've learned more today about service in metro areas that I didn't realize on some of the challenges that they're facing. So thank you for the opportunity to share that and appreciate it. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Representative Backer. We look forward to your continued work on this issue and your partnership because, as I said before, this is critical to every one of our constituents, whether they know it or not, whether they ever think about it or not. People assume that this is there for them, and we need to make sure that it really is. Thank you. Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Chair Liebling, and thank you, committee members. And Chair, yes, I would like to thank you for hearing this so quickly with Representative Backer. It is a big thing in our state, and this group has just went through and is still going through a very trying time in their careers and in the history of EMS in Minnesota with COVID. But last summer, and Representative Backer was involved with some of these, I was able to go out and meet with a lot of these stakeholders that were here today. And with their people on their crews, I sat in some living rooms and heard from them. And Mark Jones is right. We need to stop studying recruitment and retention and do something about it. And that's where I need my committee and my colleagues' help. What can be done? Where can we go? We can't just throw more money at a study. We know the problem. How can we fix it? And you heard from Representative Backer said, LifeLink 3, which is a consortium-owned model. And the reason they have a consortium is because the hospitals got together and consolidated their services. And they're not the biggest in the state, but they are the biggest in the country as far as consortium goes. And maybe we have to look at that for different ideas of what we have to do with the state. I'm not sure, but you heard from some really good people in EMS, from the board all the way down to the fire chiefs, to the police chiefs today. And it's a lot to think about. So I want to thank the chair. I want to thank the committee for listening. And I need your help. I need your help to look at what we can do here to make it better, because like Chair Liebling said, a person in my district in Apple Valley or Rosemount, Minnesota, with a two-minute response for an ambulance should be no different in the city of Wheaton for a two-minute response. And that's because my citizens in Apple Valley travel throughout the state. And we like that in Minnesota. So we want to make sure everybody's going to have the same service throughout the state. Thank you, Chair.
Well, thank you very much, Representative Hewitt. Thank you for your work on this. I haven't seen any questions from members. I know this is a lot to take in. I do see one question. I'm going to call on Representative Bonner. And go ahead, Representative Bonner.
Yeah, you know, I think maybe it's more of a comment, I guess, but I just really wanted to take a moment. I have a bit of a soft spot. Some of you may know my grandfather and father were members of the Bloomington Rescue Squad, which was an all-volunteer operation at that time and brought the family into the fold. And I know that a lot of the folks that do this work, particularly on a volunteer basis, you know, they feel a really strong desire to help the community, to do what they can for their community. And so I really commend all of those folks. And I know we had Mr. Dobish from Richfield. I grew up in Richfield. And I know that you all do really amazing, amazing work. So I want to say thank you for that. But I also wanted to kind of draw attention to something that came up too. And it was referenced a little bit with Mr. Shearer and one of the other testifiers from Hennepin Health. And, you know, by the way, my mom was at the county for 43 years, including 16 years in the ER, and she's had nothing but great things to say about our EMS professionals. But I know someone right now who works in service and does work down in the middle of Hennepin County. And I know that we sometimes don't think about EMS, but we have a lot of folks on this call who are taking calls into really dire circumstances. To do this work. They do it, they put themselves on the line day in and day out to save our loved ones. We have folks who are going into homeless encampments, dealing with issues around substance abuse and opioid abuse, homelessness, and a whole variety of other issues. So I think it was mentioned here on the call that there are a large number of issues that impact EMS services and the professionals who do this work. And I know that in particular, some of those scenarios, when we talk about retention, these are good-hearted people. They want to do the right thing, but we have to do our part as well as legislators to make sure that we're providing the supports around this so that some of those populations that are hardest hit are also in the right place. So thank you to all of you on today for all of the hard work that you do. I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart. And hopefully we'll continue this discussion more to see what more we can do to support you.
All right, thank you very much, Representative Bonner. So we're going to adjourn here in a moment. I just wanna let members know that tomorrow we will be hearing House File 11. We'll start with a brief presentation from the Department of Commerce. So we're gonna switch from actual emergency service to talking about the world of health insurance. quite a little leap there. But again, I just want to express my appreciation to our testifiers, all of you, and my appreciation for the work that you do, and those, and especially for the work of those who show up when we make that call, no matter the circumstances, as Representative Bonner has just talked about. So, what an amazing public service it really is, and. We look forward to partnering with you and helping to make the system better and stronger. And I look forward to hearing those proposals from members. So thank you, everyone. We stand adjourned.